Good morning, everyone. Before I start, I just want to say a few things about next year's meeting. I know, you know, it's a little bit too early. The incoming chair, I guess after tomorrow, I'll be the new chair after Satish. So next year, as you know, the annual meeting is going to be in San Antonio, and also it marks 75 years for the Soil Science Society. 75 years, so there will be a lot of activities. And as the new chair, you know, my main charge is to organize symposia and sessions. And that's where I really, you know, need a lot of help. As you know, that S11 is a very interdisciplinary division, which is a strength of our division. And I was at the committee meeting just on Sunday, you know, the single-digit divisions, those are old divisions. The double-digit divisions, they're more, you know, trendier and attractive. But anyway, you know, if you have ideas for some cross-disciplinary topical sessions or symposia, please let us know. You can email me, you can talk to me after, you know, I'll be around. And also, there's a business meeting today. Maybe Satish mentioned to you already. So, you know, we really need your involvement, not only as a speaker, but as, you know, organizers of stimulating sessions. Okay, thank you. My talk is not going to be 25 minutes, so I assure you, so probably more like 15 or less. The title of my talk is PPC Peas in Leachate from Turf Irrigated with Treated Wastewater. And some of you were probably in the audience for Nina Wright's talk from UNLV. And this is a different, it's the same from the same project, but from a different school and from a different site of the project. First of all, I want to give thanks to my co-authors, Nana Bonaranco, who is my former postdoc, Fred Ernst, who is a technician, and Robert Green, Jim Baird, from UC Riverside, and also Mike McCullough, he's from Northern California Golf Course Association. And I'll just follow this outline. I will speak a little bit on beneficial reuse of treated wastewater. I'm sure, you know, between yesterday and today, this has been gone over by several people. And then I'm going to say a little bit about the finding of PPCPs in treated wastewater. Then I'm going to talk about my study. And of course, there are a lot of benefits for water reuse, especially like south, you know, this southwest area of U.S. because of the arid and semi-arid climate we have, so we have very limited water supply, and also because of the growing urbanization and the climate change-induced droughts. Yeah, that's always politically right to say, I guess, climate change. And so we do really need a lot of water. And I sat on an advisory panel just last week for a groundwater replenishment project in the San Fernando Valley. And the picture going forward really looks pretty bad for AOA, this area, simply because you have less and less water supply import from other places. So really, there's a great need for water reuse. And also, on the other side, we also have to get rid of this water. You know, again, you have increased urbanization, you have more and more of this wastewater. So we do have to get rid of this water. You know, traditionally, this water is discharged into rivers or oceans. And of course, that's not the best option from an environmental perspective. So these two needs really, you know, merge together, and so we do have a great need for reuse of treated wastewater. In terms of wastewater reuse, there are many, I think, two types. One is for groundwater recharge. That's also what we call indirect potable reuse, since eventually this water will become part of your drinking water. So here you can have a replacement, like groundwater recharge. And also in this area, for example, there are there have been a couple projects to use water to push back the saltwater intrusion. And then, of course, you also have this irrigation beneficial reuse. And for irrigation, we may talk about landscape irrigation, golf course irrigation, and also ag irrigation. And I think one of the big challenge maybe is not the technology of this reuse. And it's really the public perception of this reuse. That's really the biggest challenge. And for example, groundwater recharge, even though it sounds simple, there are a lot of regulations, a lot of public resistance to that end of the use. For example, the project they're going to do in San Fernando Valley costs somewhere between $800 to $1 billion. That's what they said. And but there, really, they ask them to do advanced treatment before they release the water to the spreading grounds. So current reuse in California includes, for example, for irrigation, altogether we have about 650,000 acre feet reuse at this point. And that really represents a small portion, 8 to 10% of the total volume. Maybe that's even an optimistic estimate. However, this amount has doubled over the last 20 years. Not very fast, but 20 years. And however, the State Water Resource Control Board is encouraging the increased use, reuse. For example, by 2020, 10 years from now, we want to increase this to 2 million acre feet. And by 2030, we want to increase this to 3 million acre feet. And this is a picture of current reuse. As you can see, most of the reuse is for ag irrigation. Maybe not for food crops, but mainly for citrus, for example, or other fruit crops. And also some for landscape irrigation, and then groundwater recharge. And in California, as we know, the CDPH is the agency that sets the regulations, the limits for wastewater reuse. And you can see here, this agency has spelled out all these guidelines for the reuse. For different purposes of irrigation, you have to use different kinds of treatments for the wastewater. But you can see here, a lot of times, these are not advanced treatments. Mostly, they are secondary or tertiary treated wastewater. And water reuse is not a new concept, even though we try to make it sound like new. But for example, this is an article I pulled out from ES&T back in 1993 by a scientist from Israel. And in this article commentary, he said that in 1993, two-thirds of the wastewater, treated wastewater in Israel was being reused for irrigation. At that time, in the U.S., it was 2%. So really, you know, I think, you know, this issue has been going on for many years in some other regions. And well, now I'm going to switch gear a little bit and talk about a little bit about findings of PPCPs in treated wastewater. That, I think, between yesterday and today's talk has been gone over many times. Of course, you know, there are a lot of studies, have been a lot of studies on these. And of course, now we all know that basically there's a worldwide occurrence of these PPCPs in treated wastewater. And the bottom line is, if you care to look for them, you can always find them, either in the wastewater itself or in the water body that receives the wastewater. And you know, has been found in treated wastewater, also in treated drinking water sources, or even in groundwater sources. And also, you know, basically there have been the finding of hundreds of chemicals. And probably the list is still increasing as we getting better and better with our chemistry. And here we're talking about thousands of products. And of course, we all know that PPCPs are potentially a problem because they have endocrine disruption activities and some other antibiotic resistance implications. And also, I went over a review article in ET and C. And, you know, this article said since late 1990s, there have been over 7,000 publications on this topic worldwide. That's really daunting, I think. There's so many, there's so much research. And 90% of these 7,000 plus articles are from 1999, so basically 10 years. And also the statistics said less than 10 is on personal care products, and less than 10% is on animal medicines. And this is an article that's from Christian Dalton. And this banner shouldn't be in the... Well, this is just an example from two studies I cited from two articles from Shane Slider's group and also from Kim et al. From working with Shane Slider. Here you can see, you know, a range of different chemicals being found in treated wastewater. You know, that include antibiotics, anti-inflammatory drugs, and pain relievers, and all kinds of things. Again, if you care to look for them, you can always find them. And here, just speaking from a chemist perspective, I think it's really important nowadays that we have to use stable isotope labeled compounds, even though they are very expensive, but now they are becoming more and more available. And so that will really validate your data, and that's really important. And again, I just want to say the number of PPCPs one can find probably really is limited by your methods of detection and the use of standards. And irrigation with wastewater, historically there have been this salt issue, of course, and also this imbalance of nutrient issues since you're putting a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus into the system. And also, as the previous speaker just mentioned, there has been pathogen issue. Probably that's a more of an urgent issue nowadays. And I would want to say again, the contamination of PPCP is a potential issue, emerging issue. And basically we're looking at two types of risks. One is leaching or runoff to groundwater, but mostly I think leaching to groundwater contamination probably is a bigger concern. Leaching groundwater contamination. The other one would be accumulation in edible tissues. That's one aspect that has not been looked at very much so far. And I know that it's one of the AFRI grant focus area for this year's funding cycle. Let's look at accumulation of these PPCPs in edible tissues, like fresh produce. Okay, now I'm going to talk a little bit about our study. Again, this is a part of a big study, a very huge project involving a lot of people. And here we made use of a mature turf site. And this site was built in 1995 by a different researcher, by another researcher in our department. So this plots have been around for 15 years, so they are mature turf grass plots. And here what we did is we retrofitted the irrigation system, as you can see, with above ground irrigation sprinklers. And then we trucked in the tertiary treated wastewater and stored the water in this tank. And then we irrigate at given rates to these plots. Each plot is 6 meter by 6 meter. And in the middle of these plots, we have a cluster of drums serving as lysimeters. So basically, the water is applied to the surface, and the water percolates through these drums. Then we have pipes collecting to the site. You can see each plot has five pipes going out. So from the site of these plots, we can collect the nitrate. And this nitrate is from 90 centimeter below the surface. And for sample analysis, we just followed published methods, especially by Shane Slider's group. Here we're using a HLB SPE cartridge. We always use isotope standards We tried to analyze about 15 or 16 compounds. For each one of them, we got isotope-labeled compounds. And we used a half-liter sample, and you know, then we ran the samples on LC-MS/MS using either the positive or negative mode. And this is just an example showing the positive mode detections for some of the compounds. For some of the other, for the remaining of the compounds, we had to use a negative mode, simply because of the sensitivity issues. And this table shows you the levels of these 15 compounds that we found in the source irrigation water, which is really the tertiary treated wastewater. You can see that we always found these compounds in the treated wastewater. In here, in this case, we're talking about the average of 27 samples. We just took one sample from the storage tank every week. So this is going on for 27 weeks or 6 months about. So you can see that these compounds are always present in the tertiary treated wastewater that we used for irrigation. And this, again, includes you know, some of the common ones. We picked these compounds because, you know, studies show that they're commonly being found in treated wastewater in some other studies. And here, it's a little hard to see. What we did is we irrigated at two different rates. One is 100 ETO, one is 100% ETO, one is 130% ETO. The 130% ETO is like worst case scenario, okay, basically a lot of irrigation. And also here, it's hard to see, but we have two different soil types. One is a sandy loam, one is a loamy sand. Very sandy texture as what you normally see for on golf courses. And here, we did see the breakthrough of some of these compounds. In this case, for example, this graph shows you the breakthrough of trimethylprim in the first one. This shows you the sulfur metoxazole. That's close. you know, you did see this is going in. This is your source water. This is your concentrations in leachate. You can see, again, the source water concentration tend to be much, much higher than what you see in the leachate. But for trimethylprim, for example, sometimes the leachate concentrations could be pretty high. And also, we did see a breakthrough of primidone, for example. Again, sometimes the concentration in leachate could be pretty high. And also, we saw a little bit trace levels of meprobamate from time to time. And also, we did find carbamazepine. So those are the five drugs out of the 15 or 16 compounds that we looked for. We only saw the breakthrough of these five. And for all the others, this is what you would see. Okay, you saw them in the source water, but you don't see them in the leachate. So meaning that these chemicals did not make through the 90 centimeter soil profile appearing in the leachate. So this is a summary, removal in terms of removal. And this removal is based on the concentration of the chemicals. Basically, it's concentration in the leachate divided by the concentration in the source water. So we got removal. For some of these compounds, you can see here, this 400% ET for the sandy loam. You can see the removal for trimethylprim, for example, was not really, really very high based on concentration. That means you saw relatively high concentrations of this chemical in the leachate. Primidone, same, very similar results. And however, you know, since we're talking about irrigation, you have a leaching fraction. Okay, so the amount of water you apply to the ground to the surface would not always come out from the bottom. So if you consider the leaching fraction, then you make a calculation based on the flux, chemical flux, and this breakthrough becomes much smaller for these compounds. In this case, it's less than 5%. So this is for 130% ET for the same soil. You can see here similar pictures. We also, even for the chemicals that did breakthrough, we had pretty good removal based on the flux. And this is for a different soil, 100% ET. Again, we're seeing a brick soil pyrimidon and trimethoprim. And this is for 130% ET. And if you recall from Nina's talk yesterday, in the laximeters that they did at the UNLV, they saw the breakthrough of exactly the same chemicals. So, you know, basically our study really serves as a validation of the laximeter study, even though this is also a laximeter study, but we did it under a more realistic conditions, I think. So that really, these two studies together really show that some of the PPCPs could break through in soil if you use irrigation of the treated wastewater. However, we did see that soil or the turf grass system has a very good capacity of removal, of removing these chemicals. So again, to summarize this, we did see a lot of PPCPs in the treated wastewater that we used for irrigation. And a few of these PPCPs, like trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole, pyrimidon, carbamazepine, for example, they did appear in the leachate after 6 months of pretty intense irrigation. However, based on the mass fraction was relatively small, suggesting that the soil turf grass system was pretty capable of removing these chemicals or retaining these chemicals. And many of the PPCPs were completely removed, likely due to degradation or maybe plant uptake. However, you know, we did not really look into that. So that's always a question. So from here, we can conclude that turf grass, in this case, you know, by also extension, you have lawns for a lot of landscape systems. So turf grass or grass can serve as a very effective biofilter. And of course, a couple of remaining questions. We don't know what happens to the other PPCPs that you may find in the treated wastewater. And also the mechanisms of removal, we really don't know. And more importantly here, I think, you know, every time when we our project was being reviewed by the panel, they always have this question of plant uptake. And that's one question I think the USDA, the AFRI grant is trying to address, especially I think for edible food crops. I think that's going to be you know, a good direction for research, much needed research. And this project was funded by WERF and also Water Reuse Foundation. And the money truly came from many, many different water and sanitation districts. And the list is just too long to list. And here, these are our collaborators on this project. That's all I have. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions. And if you have other questions for previous speakers also, since we go in 15 minutes of our session.
Okay.
The question is, for this study, you only irrigate your turf grass for, you know, a number of weeks. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, we continue to have the water effluent from whatever source. If you continue to irrigate your field year after year, do you think eventually the turf will reach the capacity that you're leaching probably high, let's say 10 years after 10 years, probably the leaching breakthrough curve may be different?
Yeah, that's a you know, of course, a very good comment. Actually, part of this, another part of this experiment was to look at some, take samples from some real golf courses that have been irrigated for many, many years. I don't have the data here. Dale.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, so we have a site in Las Vegas that's been irrigated for 50 years with reuse water, and we have the shallow groundwater system we monitor. So we pick up sulfamethoxazole, carbamazepine, there's a number of them. But they're also the same ones that we are detecting in the long-term glycemeter study.
Yeah, but that's of course. Could go either way. If you irrigate longer, you could have more microbes, I guess, right, adapting to these chemicals, and could enhance the removal, but of course, you know.
Very informative presentation. I have a question that you showed the leaching potential of a couple of chemicals, persicare products. But do you think there was some unique thing about the chemicals which you did detect in the leachate? Was there a unique property of those chemicals? Is it related to solubility or maybe the absorption potential?
I think it probably really has a lot to do with the persistence. I mean, resistance to degradation. You know, more than the KOW, because these chemicals are all relatively soluble. Some of them have some sorption to soil, but I think you know, the degradation potential probably is a real important factor.
So the solubility range is, would you say, is it in the PPM range? Yeah,
these chemicals, I think, since they are human drugs, they tend to be relatively water soluble. Otherwise, you know, we cannot really absorb them. Yes.
Did you measure? Did you try to analyze those compounds in the soil profile?
We did. We did. Afterwards, we took some soil cores, and we did see the residues of some of the chemicals, but not really accumulation. Since we did this for 6 months, we didn't really see a significant you know, accumulation in the soil profile. Yes.
Gee, very good work. Question. We've done similar work on animal farming, animal wastewater irrigation applications, and you know, I think we're all sort of at the beginning stages of evaluating this. But especially the environmental community is also asking, what happens with the degradation products? Have you guys looked at degradation products at all?
I don't. No, we have not. But I guess you know, very few people have, simply because you're talking about so many different classes of chemicals. You know, unlike these chemicals, the parent compounds is hard enough. I mean, you know, I'm sure, you know, that will be one of the future directions. Okay, one more.
correct me if I'm wrong, but your site is a couple of years old, and you also have a very good turf grass growing in that condition. Most of the reclaimed water that's used in new communities have relatively new turf with very shallow root system. So I wonder how your results will be different if you irrigate. I mean, the way that I'm looking at it looks like the best case scenario, when you have a turf, good root system, very good degradation, and not much protection. If you start with a new turf, and you have very shallow soils, and you have closed groundwater, then you might have a higher risk. But what I'm interested in knowing is about your lysimeter setup. What was the proportion of water that was recovered as leachate? Can you comment on that?
You know, it's I think based on the water leaching fraction, I think it's about somewhere below 25%. The water going in, the water coming out. And of course, you're right. I mean, you know, different systems would be very different. And this is a mature turf grass system. And you may have very different results if you have a new, complete new site. Okay, thank you very much.